Coming up in this episode.
It's been a fascinating ride. It's been like Toad Hall's wild ride, and a bit like his wild ride, as far as I remember the book anyway. It wasn't really planned, it evolved.
The Logistics Collective podcast is a series focused on the logistics industry, where there are many incredible stories to be told. We'll be speaking with those who've worked and are working within the industry today. What have been their experiences, good and bad, since joining, and would they recommend a career in the industry to others? Here's your host, Malcolm Pope.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the third episode of Logistics Collective, the podcast. Thank you to everyone that's listened to the prior episodes, and thank you for a lot of the kind comments that we've received as a result of this. Today, I have Keith Purdon, who's a former CEO of Servicer, and now he works as a strategic consultant helping businesses to develop in the aviation sector. And Keith's had an absolutely fascinating career. So, hello, Keith, and where does today find you?
Hi, good afternoon. I guess I should first of all say how flattered I am that you've invited me to take part. I've been working from home for 20 years, and my wife commandeered my office recently, so I'm in the dining room in Wilmslow.
Seems like a perfectly nice place to be. I hope you've got suitable beverages around you to support you. Keith, you've had a really long and very successful career. What was your starting point?
Well, we had no family history of university, and I assumed I was going to leave school the first moment I could at 16. Four O-levels were not going to get me on a path of accounting or lawyering, both of which required an extra study, which I'm not a person who is very academically drawn. A friend's mum said, "You're always hitchhiking around the country watching your football team, why don't you join a travel company?" So I did. My first day at work, this young kid from not the wrong side of the tracks, but quite close to the tracks, was taking calls from all the former colonies that spoke English for booking coach tours around England. And it was astonishing. I couldn't believe I was talking to Australia and Canada and Ghana and Nigeria, and it was just stunning, and I was hooked from that very first day.
I mean, when you were in school, did you have a dream job you were aspiring to?
It was obvious I was going to open the bowling for England and play centre forward, but I fear now in my early 70s I may not catch Mr. Southgate's eye, so I'd vaguely thought I'd like to do something in TV. I did a lot of improvisation acting at a local arts centre, and loved just using your wits to make stuff up. But as soon as I found somebody who was willing to pay me to go flying abroad, like I say, I was hooked. I loved the international element. I loved the diversity. My dad had been in India in the military, and he was always talking about how much he loved it. Ironically, I've never been. But so I just loved the international element of it. I loved that, this might be a theme we return to, I started right at the bottom, and I do think logistics in its wider sense, you know, one of my sons joined a very large company because he'd got a degree in logistics, and yet logistics seems to me it's open to his level, his type of entrant, and mine, where you start at the bottom and you throw yourself in it and you work bloody hard and there's no ceiling to your talents.
No. And so, you know, recap, 4 O-levels, left school at 16, CEO of a major aviation business. I mean, that was one heck of a journey. I mean, utterly fascinating. I mean, how did you begin to make your steps up? How did that work for you?
I think the first thing is I've had two wonderful mentors. Yeah. I learned a lot from, and they were very supportive. The first guy, who's sadly had to retire because of ill health and subsequently died, when he retired, he told the board I was taking his place. No ifs, no buts. And I was on the board at 27 of a holiday company. probably before I was really ready at board level. And I think there is a recurring theme, Malcolm, that I've always volunteered for stuff. A couple of times, I'm getting out of sequence, but at Service Air, I was sales director for the passenger and ramp business, and I went and told the CEO I thought the cargo, the logistics business, was a right mess, and he asked me a few questions, then he announced that I was the new managing director, but I'd still got to be the sales director. So, I hadn't seen that coming, but I didn't know. I don't mean politically promote yourself, but one of the things I've said to my own kids, volunteer for the horrible stuff that nobody else wants to do, get stuck in. And I don't totally believe this, just between you and me, but hard work covers an awful amount of lack of talent. And I've always worked very hard.
I would certainly agree with that, but I would question your lack of talent. There's got to be a little bit more than hard work that pulls this all together, and I guess it's how we interact with the people around us and how we treat them and how they treat us and really all of that. If you could pick one experience in your career and say that was your pinnacle, that was the best, what would it be?
I think being appointed CEO, because we were taken over and I lost the role and indeed my job within a year, but I think the recognition that I could that contribute widely across the business, I think. But within that, there was one thing. I'm a big believer in the theatre of business, particularly the theatre of sales, and I won't name any names, but we'd won a major airlines cargo business, and it was a mega piece of business. It came at a very appropriate time when we were particularly struggling. And I went to Dubai to a conference just so that I could meet the decision maker at this airline. And I sat by him at dinner, and he had a lot more to drink than I did. And he told me that price wasn't the important thing. They were doing very nicely, thank you very much. But quality was stinking. And I went back and we changed our proposal. We didn't move the price, but we changed the goalposts. We did things like, you can have your cargo within 2 hours of wheels down, not 4 hours. You can deliver cargo to our airfield warehouse up to 2 hours prior to departure instead of 4 hours. Things which broke the mold and things which nobody else was doing. It was just standard. It's 4 hours. And it put a lot of cost in, but we won the business. And the pinnacle bit of your question is we then screwed up. We didn't deliver the quality at all. And along with one of my colleagues, we decided that we would relocate our own personal offices, in my case, from Manchester Airport to another airport location. Well, I might as well say it was Heathrow. And literally, I moved my office into the customer's offices at Heathrow, along with a colleague. And I said, we will go back home when you tell us we're meeting your expectations. And the theatre of that just was stunning. I had a thank you from the board of the airline eventually for my commitment. And there's been one or two things I'm quite proud of along the way, but making my kids proud is what I'm proudest of all.
I'm absolutely sure. And I know you've got some wonderful children and wonderful grandchildren as well. Absolutely all the apple of your eye. And
absolutely, they are.
That's the reason why we actually do work. That's to get it into perspective. As much as we enjoy what we do in our working environment, it's there for a reason. And I think sometimes some misplace that. We shouldn't. If that's, you know, the best career experience, and I really support you in terms of that reach out to customer. I mean, not enough logistics providers decide to get out there and have those conversations ahead. And I think that sort of commitment to say, well, okay, we've also got to put ourselves there and correct something that is going wrong and show that leadership, I think is really creditable and well done to you. But we've spoken about, there's a bit of best and worst in that, I guess. But what was the really worst time for you and what did you learn from it?
There's a number of answers to that. I think I did 18 months as a consultant for a law firm, and I was way out of my comfort zone. I was largely training lawyers who were, top of their field of speciality, to be business development people. And, the common answer was, if I'd wanted to be a salesman, I wouldn't have studied for 7 years, Keith. But that was the reality. They had to bring business in. They couldn't sit Sure. there. And it doesn't work for somebody else to bring business. They've got to look the lawyer in the eyes and be comfortable. So I didn't really enjoy that. And I've been made redundant twice in my career. The first time I'd got something else lined up. And so I was fortunate to get a nice payoff and start a new job 6 weeks later. The second time from Service Air was a low because I just loved the work. I loved focusing on, I'm quite obsessed with quality. And I loved trying to support colleagues, drive quality, drive safety. Any business that's airside at an airport, you need safety to be number one focus for your staff, sure. Never mind the equipment and the aircraft, which are quite expensive. So there'd be a number of things that usually when I failed to do something, when I didn't... I didn't grasp something quickly enough. I think the decisions I've made that I think I could have done better were usually when I erred on the side. Kindness may not be quite the right word, but maybe I wasn't tough enough. Yep. Maybe I should have dismissed somebody and I gave them a second, third, fourth chance or something. So there's not a lot. I'm a big believer in you look forward. If you can ruin the future by worrying about the past. And in the main, I look forward. But there are one or two decisions usually around people that I wish I'd done differently.
Okay. What do you wish you would have known when you started your career? So if you could go back and talk to 16-year-old Keith who was starting his career, what advice would you be giving him?
Almost everything. I think one of the things was the holiday company I joined at 16, we were extremely entrepreneurial. Nobody had ever sold package holidays before. Nobody knew what to do if a hotel was overbooked and you'd got a plane load of passengers arriving at midnight on Christmas Eve. There wasn't a manual. You couldn't look it up. So it was a great learning experience. And I got a lot of encouragement on quality from my boss at the time. He was obsessed with detail because if you get the detail right, you deliver the customer's expectations. I often made myself too busy to go on courses, and I think that was a serial error. Mm-hmm. I do think in retrospect that I might have advanced more quickly or done a better job if I understood more about the accounts, the balance sheet earlier in Sure. my career. I'm talking to an entrepreneur, I know, but you have to follow the cash. You have to follow the money. Profits, yes, but second to the cash. And I think the young Keith, I wasn't exposed to it. I avoided going on courses because I was too busy. I didn't want to study in the evenings or whatever. And I would say in today's world that qualifications will be more important, but you can gain them on the job if you make yourself available and put yourself forward. AT&T, by the way, were brilliant at that. They sent me on all sorts of courses. Yeah. 4 weeks in Switzerland was one that was really cathartic in terms of opening my eyes, particularly opening my eyes to different cultures and how different cultures work.
Okay. So thinking back over your life and career, who's inspired you the most?
Probably a guy called John Willis, who was chairman at Service Air. Mm-hmm. I think in the same breath, I should say, you know, my wife Leslie was bringing up two boys while I was working at Service Air, and I was some weeks on a flight, 6 days of the week. So although I don't think inspired in a business sense, but absolutely we were a partnership, and, you know, I genuinely, I couldn't have done it if she wasn't willing to have been the homemaker before she herself went back to her career. John Willis is the doyen of the ground handling passenger and cargo industry. My knowledge, he's never written a book, but he should and he could. He's in demand all over the world and recognised all over the world. And one of the things that I was smart enough to say to him when I went for my interview was I wanted to be able to say to him, I don't know, John, I'll find out, but at this moment, I don't know. And he responded brilliantly to that. And when I said, I don't know, he usually told me the answer anyway. He was also very open. I'm quite, I'm not shy. I was very, very shy growing up, but I'm not shy in the boardroom, and I express opinions or question things. And he was very open to that. And of course, there does come a moment when you say, okay, I've lost this argument. I now have to back John's opinion as if it was my own and get on with it. And he was a very good teacher, a very good role model, and I'm proud to say is a good close personal friend now.
That's a wonderful tribute. But, you know, there are people in our careers that are the leading lights and that make the difference to us and open doors for us. And you always got to be, I always think you've got to have your eyes wide open about those. I can point to a couple in my career that made an absolute incredible difference in terms of what I managed to achieve. So, hey, Chris, if you're listening, thank you very much. What really has surprised you most about, I mean, your sector of the logistics industry in terms of aviation most recently?
I think the sector is finally catching up on green issues. I think we're finally catching up on innovation. One of the things that struck me when I joined Service Air was colleagues would say to me, but Keith, we've always done it this way. It used to drive me mad because sometimes they were absolutely right. There was a very good reason why we'd always done it this way. Of course, there were plenty of occasions when they weren't. And I think the relationship between the logistics, pure logistics, the freight forwarders, the trucking companies, the ground handling, cargo ground handling at the airports, I think it's grown up. A case in point would be Donata at Heathrow. They did something really simple. Very proud to say the guy who led them at the time used to be my accountant at Service Air. But Gary came up with something so blindingly obvious and wonderful that typically airline offices are on the mezzanine floor of a cargo building, a cargo warehouse. And you can imagine, I'm sure many of your listeners will know very well, it's noisy, it's dirty, it's old-fashioned. It is not a place, if you showed a 16-year-old looking to whether he wanted or she wanted a career in logistics, it's not going to sell them on the idea. So when they built new facilities at Heathrow, completely new cargo warehousing, a lot of IT improvements, but he gave the airlines fabulous offices. He gave them the sort of offices that their passenger colleagues work in, branded, clean, tidy, subsidized canteen, clean toilets. And it's like, it's not rocket science, is it? But it was such a revelation at the time in the context of new facilities and, if you like, a new breaking all the molds that were possible. And I think I don't know the inside and outside of their accounts, but they certainly won a lot of new business, and they had customers who were incredibly loyal to them because of the leadership of Gary and his almost entirely female management team.
There's a big message in there which says treat your employees and partners with respect and treat them decently. You always do get a return from that. And whilst we always need to look at the bottom line, there are choices that can be made that really make things better. I have a common saying is that you can't build a business with a machete.
I've not heard that, but that's good.
But you can't. And I've seen so many businesses go and they're on a downward spiral to over cost control. And there's no business without risk. That's part of the joy of business.
I think one of the things in that about treating people correctly, I learned fairly late in the day from AT&T that they insisted that each operating division had employee of the month type scheme. And I was a late adapter. But actually at Service Air, I did a couple of things around managing directors going the extra mile award. Mm-hmm. And without going into all the details, there's a gentleman at Stansted who stopped a plane taking off because he could smell petrol in the warehouse after they'd put everything on the plane. And one of the F1 cars they'd loaded was leaking petrol on the plane. So I gave him a very well-merited award. Fast forward 10 years later, I go in and I'm told, I can't remember his name, I'm apologies if he ever listens to this, but I was told this guy wanted to see me. And I said, but I don't know anyone here. And he said, you do, he's the one you gave the award to. And he said, yep, it's on my mantelpiece. It's still there. Everybody comes to the house, ask me about it. It's still there. Thank you. And it's like, yeah, recognition is due and it's appropriate. And by golly, it works.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. If you could pick just a couple of things, what's fundamentally changed about, let's say, the aviation industry and specifically air cargo from when you started within it, perhaps to your view of it today? What's been the biggest changes?
I think a gradual focus more on quality than on price. Not saying that price isn't important. I think as well, one of the things that happened probably in the late 1900s was airlines started having procurement managers, and they were not, in my experience, they weren't focused on anything but going back to the office and saying, hey, I'm a clever boy or a girl, I've saved 5%, ha, ha, ha. And no thought was given, but yeah, you've saved 5%, but the quality's going to stink. Yeah. I think that has changed a lot. And I think that some of the IT systems that are around now give a lot of power, a lot of negotiating strength to airlines, ground handlers, trucking companies, logistics companies, because it's not anecdotal anymore. One of the things that used to drive me mad was people saying, oh, you're always leaving our cargo off the plane. And it's like, nope. It's happened twice this year, once because it was damaged on arrival and once was our fault. But it's changed anecdotes into facts. And if you've got facts, you can really deal with them.
Sure.
I read a book by a guy called Tom Peters about quality, and he inspired me, I have to say, to further be obsessed about quality, about communication. So the answer to your question, I think, is around IT is making a big difference. There's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of cost of labor going out with, you know, less 747s loosely loaded coming in and more containerized, more professional overall, I would say. Well, perhaps since I left, it's got much more professional, but yes, more professional.
Do you think it's lost anything? What's the counterpoint to this more systemization, more data, this sort of sense of professionalism arguable?
I don't instantly think of something that's lost. I do think in my narrow niche in aviation, the interesting people worked in cargo, not exclusively, of course, but there were more moving parts in cargo. A cargo couldn't complain or tell you, hey, you've left me in the warehouse like a passenger can at the gate. So
not yet.
A lot of interest. Not maybe that'll come. Yeah, it is an industry, in my view, with a lot of interesting people with interesting ideas. There are so many moving parts, But then there are so many roles that, again, going back to sort of the nub of your opening question, really, whether you come in as, you know, no O-levels or the magnificent four that I got, or you come in with a university degree, there are paths for you if you want them. And it seems to me that, you know, there are so many roles around, you know, things such as health and safety, warehousing, trucking, customs, customer relations, yeah, sales, whatever.
And on top of that, you've got human resources, you've got IT, you've got the whole business in terms of business development, you've got quality within that. I mean, it's like a microcosm of a full list of career opportunities for people.
Yes, it absolutely is. And there's one thing, I don't know if this is quite the moment, we're talking about careers. One thing I think I learned is it's your career. Nobody else is going to be as interested in it as you. Whatever your boss says,
good advice,
he or she is not as interested as you. So you have to manage your own career. You have to send it in the direction, the best direction that you're capable of. And in my case, that was usually by working really hard. I had fantastic role models. My parents did 3 and 4 jobs between them. So, you know, right from the very beginning, I worked in the office Monday to Friday. I worked at the airport for 3 times as much money at the weekend. And then I did an insurance round in the week because that was the model I had from my parents. So, and I just took that, and that's what I've lived in my career.
So coming towards the end of the interview, and again, thank you so much, but in the last few minutes of the interview, I'd like to give some focus on giving advice to people considering a career in logistics. And I understand that you've got an absolute sectoral focus, and it's a very valuable sector. Do you think it's still a good idea for people to consider logistics and supply chain industry as a perhaps even a top three career choice? And if so, why?
I do, because of the width of opportunity. At 16 or 18 or 21, whatever you're going to enter the workplace, you probably don't really know. If you're really lucky, you might know. I've all my life, I wanted to be a lawyer or a baker or something. You may have that. I didn't. So logistics will offer such a wide arena. You know, if you want to get into HR, there's a lot of companies out there that will support you going into training. If you want to become health and safety expert or efficiency or whatever, I believe there's a lot of practical training. There's a lot of willingness to support you. So, I mean, to me, yes, absolutely. Do not go in blindfold. It's a 24/7, 365 industry. You are not going to work every day of your life from 0900 to 1700 and go home and forget about it. You know, if the phone goes at 2 o'clock in the morning, as it did once for me, to be told we've had a fatality on the ramp, you can't say, but I'm asleep, good night. You get up and you go to the airport and you deal with it. So, it's a demanding workplace. I think it's an exciting one. I think the limitations are driven by you. And I think what we've seen during COVID with people changing jobs, your skills will be in demand. You're not confining yourself to the next 50 years of the job you start with. You are building up a repertoire of skills, knowledge, and personal character that you can take many other places, and for that matter, many other countries. You know,
I mean, that's a fantastic outlook, and I can see, you know, the evolution of your career. I mean, I guess you followed a track of I'm interested in that, and let's go. And you've been brave enough to actually take the next step. I don't sort of sense there was a I'm going to be this and do this. I think there was, you correct me if I'm wrong, that there was this desire to say, well, okay, make a start and then look for the opportunities.
I think so. Of course, I mean, I nearly said sort of we generally speaking, yeah, but let me say I don't think I really had a career plan. I do remember I'd only been working about 2 or 3 years and I was earning more than my dad. And that was an incredible milestone.
Sure.
And I think he was astonished at one level. I mean, I didn't have a highfalutin job at the time, but I was then doing two jobs. So, yeah, push for the opportunities, ask for them, don't be a wallflower. I was very, very shy when I started work, and I remember thinking this is going to hold me back. And the first thing I can remember doing to address it was we'd been asked by the Women's Guild to go and give a talk about package holidays. And I said, I'll do that. And the boss said, but you've never done it before. And I said, no, that's why I want to do it now. And yeah, it was an incredible challenge. But at probably 17 at the time, I had all these old ladies fawning over me because they thought I was a good public speaker. And so I overcame that limitation of mine. I don't know, quite deliberately, let's say.
I think you've helped some creativity in my thinking. And the new title for a CEO is a highfaluter. I think that's a really good potential name to use, although a lot of very, very inspiring CEOs out there. What advice would you give to somebody starting out now? I mean, what would you, practical advice?
Turn up on time. I was late the first day at work. Just be the best that you can day after day after day. I'm very into my sport, but if you're a footballer, there's no use being brilliant one week and hopeless the next. So you really got to shine. I had a brilliant interface with a young lady at British Airways recently. Our flight was delayed. She was on the information desk and she said, I'm sorry, I don't know. And then she said, and I have quoted her to British Airways without giving her name away, I'm reasonably new. I come into work every day wanting to do my very best for the customers because that's what inspired me to join British Airways. But they don't give me the tools to let me shine and let me, because you know more about this flight being late than I do on my on my system. And I just thought she will go far.
Yep.
She might be frustrated today, but resilience would come into the answer to your question somewhere, because not every day is a good one. Don't be frightened to break the mold. But, you know, I'm not really a maverick. I've done a couple of maverick things in my time, which luckily for me both paid off. One was nailing our bad quality results to the door where all the customers could see them as a way of inspiring my management that I was actually serious and we were going to improve because we were going to put the results on the door every week. So I'm waffling, sorry.
No, you're not. You're giving some really good information. I mean, the person from British Airways, I mean, I think she just needs some time to, and the bravery to go find her voice and go and challenge back up the line. I think people like that, they should have C-suites and senior VPs and directors absolutely encouraging them to tell the truth to power. Telling truth to power is really important because it's actually trying to protect the most senior position. So I think that's forgotten about perhaps sometimes. Sort of as a wrap-up, I mean, you know, yes, the logistics industry and certainly also the aviation industry can be a challenge. It's not 9 to 5 and... but it has an immense variety of task and challenge and travel and everything associated with it and systems. In your career, so here's the thing that I think is special about the logistics industry. How many friends have you made?
That's an interesting one. Quite a number.
Yeah.
I had lunch with six of them the other day in Prestbury, oddly enough. And my old boss, John Willis, it's his 80th coming up and he's got 40 of us for dinner. I'm not very good at making friends with people I work with. It always seems a bit of a conflict of interest. But now I'm no longer at Service Air. I have very good friendships with a number of the people that I worked with. Now I'm no longer in a position that they're my boss or I'm their boss. We're just Keith and whoever. But interesting people, all of them, real deep skills in their particular niches, and a lot of respect, a lot of shared travel, a lot of shared problems. Do you remember when? So it's been a fascinating ride. It's been like Toad Hall's wild ride, and a bit like his wild ride, as far as I remember the book anyway. It wasn't really planned. It evolved. It was steered. And go right back to the beginning, if I hadn't had John Willis at Service Air and Michael Haig Webster at Horizon Holidays as mentors, I'm not sure I would have been asked to come on this podcast today. Let's put it like that.
Well, that's fantastic. All I'm going to say to you, Keith, is thank you and poop, poop. On with Toad and Toad Hall and his journey. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's wonderful to actually get somebody to share a fraction. I mean, you know, you can't, in terms of a career, share so much, but I think we've got some real key elements within there, and humbly thank you very, very much for that.
Now, again, I'm very flattered that you'd invite me, and I hope it helps in the recruitment of people to the industry and telling them, you know, if I can do it, they can do it.
Thanks again, Keith. So to the listeners, do remember, we publish the podcast on several platforms, but if you go to the web link and press follow, we'll actually give you an update when the next editions are actually going to come out. And we've got a whole number of people that are queuing to come and have a chat with me. I only hope my voice holds out, because I'm powered on Strepsils at the moment. That's why I'm sounding a bit Barry White today. Anyway, look, thanks again.
You can get in contact by email, podcast@logisticscollective.com, or leave a voice message on our website, logisticscollective.com. The podcast is a production by LeGuru.